Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is A Lot to Learn with Austin Rogers. For the guy who knows everything, he's still got a lot to learn. Without further ado, here's Austin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good night. I have no idea what time it is because it's a podcast and people listen to podcasts whenever they might listen to podcasts. Oh my God, is this one going to be awesome? He's already laughing. We've got Steve Metz, who is the superintendent of the Redwood National and State Park System here in Northern California. Superintendent, that's the big boss.
That's correct, yeah.
That is awesome. Yeah. So today we're going to talk about the National Park System, you know, a little bit of history of it, where it came from, where it's going. But for those of you career-minded, how does one get into this path? Because it's not something you could just pick up and start and be like, I'm going to work for the National Parks. It doesn't work that way. Welcome, Steve.
Welcome. Thanks so much for coming to Northern California. We love you. Love to have you here.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Now, if we go off the rails a little bit, just know that Steve and I have known each other for quite some time, and we go on baseball trips together. You could probably surmise what a group of now middle-aged men do on baseball trips. It's actually more wholesome than you think, but
it is.
So if we get on little tangents or asides, just know that we got history. So, Steve, here you are, the superintendent of Redwood. This is a name brand recognition national park. This is Grand Canyon, Denali, Glacier, right? Yosemite, Yellowstone, Redwood. It's in the same sentence as these.
Yes.
But how many other national parks are there?
Oh, there's over 400. And there are many other Park Service units with them. With national parks themselves, there's about 60 of them. There's different categories of National Park Service units that exist. But of national parks, there's about 60 throughout the country.
Right. And you are in one of the premier, the jewels of the crown of the park system. But it wasn't always that way.
That's right. Yeah, this is the culmination of my career, and I'm very happy to be here.
Well, let's walk through that. Let's walk through, you know, literally from the start, the day one, I decide, when does one decide they want to join the Park Service? Is this like, hey, I'm really into ecology or history back in the day, and maybe this is the great career path, or I don't even know.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. I mean, you have to have a passion for this type of career. And so I started actually all the way back in New Jersey working for the county park systems. And I worked in a variety of different jobs there, including law enforcement and maintenance and doing other things, including being a naturalist, which is what we now call in the federal government an interpretation. We give programs and other things on that. Then I went to college and I got my master's degree, and as I got out of that, I got into science. I worked for the Grizzly Bear Recovery Program, working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, making maps of different linkage zones between large areas of habitat for grizzly bears, so they can move between them and try to protect those areas between large contiguous areas. From there, I worked for a variety of jobs, but I always wanted to work for the Park Service, because I always wanted to work in the management of these protected areas. And we moved to Flagstaff, and I worked for the Grand Canyon Monitoring Research Center, which was a unit of the U.S. Geological Survey. And we were studying the effects of the Glen Canyon Dam on the Colorado River and all the impacts that large hydroelectric dam was having on the river. But it was very challenging for me because I wanted to get involved in the management of it. But in being part of USGS, it was all science-based. And so at that point, I moved over to the Park Service so I could get more involved in management.
So you had a huge, basically, base of a pyramid that just pointed ever upward towards being in the parks department because you worked locally, mm-hmm. you honed your science skills, you worked for the USGS, you did the grizzly bear, mm-hmm. but none of this was, well, obviously USGS is federal, but none of this was within the park service because USGS is a separate entity.
Correct. So I always had my goal that I wanted to work for the park service because the mission for the park service is so much part of what I feel in my heart of what I want to do, that the park service is about preserving these large natural areas and also providing for the recreation of for folks too, so they can enjoy it and really appreciate those natural areas and protect them. And so that was always a part of what I wanted to do. And so I just worked towards that career. And once I got into the Grand Canyon, I worked for a long time as both a GIS analyst, a geographic information system map maker, but then eventually became the natural resource chief for Grand Canyon. And then after that, I became superintendent at a park. And that was the big step in my career, where stepping from a science position into a management position.
Yes. Right. And I'm assuming that leap is not is that leap unique, or is that a traditional route, or are there more rote routes to get towards where you've reached?
So in the past, in the Park Service, the traditional route to superintendency, to being the big boss at a park, would be through law enforcement. Because they kind of handle all the big crisis in the park. They handle all that.
Uh-huh.
Now it's shifted to be much more, it's much more eclectic. Now, almost any group could be part of that, but especially because of the complicated resource issues that we deal with in resource management, where I was part of, we have much more ability to move up into the management ranks because a lot of the challenges at the parks are based on ecological challenges.
Right. Okay. So, like, back in the day of, like, wooden-sailed and wood-hulled British Navy. This is relevant. The gunnery lieutenants, those were the ways to advance, prowess. Okay. Yeah. But then the steam engines introduced, and everyone poo-pooed the people in the engineering lieutenancies. But ultimately, they're the ones who ended up running the new Navy, the new British Navy, the ironclad and the dreadnought British Navy were run by the engineers, not run by the flashy gunnery captains anymore, right?
I mean, I can't believe you brought that home. I'm amazed. Yes, that's exactly right.
Right.
Yes, that's exactly right. There's been a shift in terms of the skill set that is needed to be superintendent. It's much more, the complexity of being superintendent is much more around resource, ecological issues, climate change, those type of issues, than it is around, say, law enforcement or public management.
Right, right. And now you said that you gained your first superintendency. Is that a word, superintendency?
Sure it is.
Super Nintendo Chalmers. early 90s Simpsons for you young folks. So you gained your first Super Nintendo...
Purple Monkey Dishwasher.
Purple Monkey Dishwasher. You gained your first super... Oh, my God. You got your first park.
There you go.
You got your first park, but you don't just immediately hop straight into Redwood or Grand Canyon or something like that.
That's right.
You had a term before we were eating dinner right beforehand, and before we start, you said there was a term that you didn't know if you really wanted to say, but you go through a rotation.
Right. And so if you're interested in being in senior leadership in the Park Service, you're going to have to work at parks that maybe not as desirable as what you might be envisioning. You don't work your way into a Yosemite or a Redwood. And so I started at a park. My first superintendency was at Missouri National Recreational River, which is a wild and scenic portion of the main stem Missouri River in South Dakota.
Right. Ooh. Oh, yeah. The Missouri's all the way up there.
Correct.
Missouri's the longest river system in the country.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, the Missouri-Mississippi River system. Mississippi's the longest river. The Missouri. Yeah. Well, we got it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so...
We're joined by friends and family around this dinner table right now. So if you hear some of the cackles, it's because we're pretty humorous.
I think we are. And we could talk about the geography, but Missouri is. I just want to point out for my peeps in South Dakota, Nebraska, that Missouri is slightly longer than the Mississippi when it joins the Mississippi, and is larger in terms of volume. So I just want to point that out. I feel like I need to do that to give the props to my friends on the Missouri River.
All right. I was either misinformed or my World Almanac 1988 ain't cutting it no more. There's an East Germany? Oh, Jesus. Awesome. Yeah, so you have to run the gamut of, and by the way, all these parks are incredibly valuable to the localities in which they're located and immeasurable for the preservation of our country, but they just don't have the glamour and the glitz of Grand Canyon.
That is correct. That's right. So I moved from one of the big glam parks of Grand Canyon to Missouri National Recreation River, but the challenges were the same. I was working on the Colorado River working on regulated river issues related to Glen Canyon Dam. Same things happening on the Missouri River. The impacts upon the sedimentation, the impacts upon the ecology, upon the fishery are pretty much identical. They're large rivers and the same impacts are happening and the same rules apply. The important thing is, it doesn't matter whether the park is a Grand Canyon or Missouri National Recreation River, the same rules apply. We treat the parks all the same.
Right, and water still runs downhill.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So then after this, you know, what sort of public is served by the Missouri Regional Park?
Yeah, So a lot of what we were serving were a lot of anglers. There was a lot of recreational hunting and a lot of the more traditional, what you would think of people that they would use for the river. But the most important part was that Congress had designated it as a wild and scenic river stretch. And what that means is a very specific law was passed the same year as the Wilderness Act that kept the rivers wild. That meant there couldn't be development along the river. And that was mostly what the resource challenges were, because it was in a highly agricultural area, highly developed area, and so folks would want to develop along the river, and we were there to kind of say, okay, you want to do that, that's great, let's talk about how we can do that, but still preserve those values by which Congress said to maintain this river as a wild and scenic river.
Right, responsibly and whatnot.
Exactly.
And also, I mean, one of the huge environmental crises of our time is, you know, dealing with agricultural runoff. How do you
that's
even
right.
get into that?
So we worked in partnership. There were many, many groups that were working on the Missouri River to try to restore the ecology of the river and restore the endangered species along the river. And we worked with them. A lot of times the USDA had a Soil Conservation Service, which it used to be known as, would work to preserve those soils and those type of things. And we'd work with them on with our landowners that were around the river on those issues.
Okay, yeah. So this is not necessary. I mean, the mandate is top down, obviously, federal downwards. Mm-hmm. But for the boots on the ground, like superintendents of your park and mm-hmm. other smaller parks, you're really working hand in hand with the localities and even the citizenry embedded in and around your park, because people live and work in these parks and natural wildernesses.
That's exactly right.
Because when we think of parks, we think of, well, no one lives in Central Park. Well, who would live in Central Park? Well, that one crazy guy lives in Central Park. But people live and work. I think that's one thing that maybe people don't understand. Like the scope of scale of some of these wildernesses parks are tens of thousands, and if not hundreds of thousands of people live and work and sustain themselves on these federal protected lands. So there's got to be some sort of public-private partnership going on.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. We had over 700 private landowners within our boundaries of our national recreational river. And so that meant we worked with private landowners. We worked with 11 counties, worked with two states. It was a lot of engagement, a lot of partnership. Everything we did was working in partnership with the local landowners to try to work with them to talk about what we were trying to conceive and what we were trying to do to keep Congress and keep the congressional intent of keeping this a wild and scenic river while also allowing them to have a job and maintain their farms.
Right.
And so we had to be reasonable. We had to work with them on those issues. And that was a big part of the job. I actually love that part of the job because it gets me out there talking to folks and they could just talk to me and we just worked it out.
Worked it out.
That's
how many
right.
black helicopters did you send for the ones who now...
I did not own any black helicopters at that park.
At that park.
Other parks, yeah.
That was just like sort of a black quad bike, and they'd pick you up and be like, you're coming with us. Dave, is that you on the black quad bike? Yeah, I know, but still, you're coming with us. You're going to the secret location, right? So next park.
Yes.
What's next?
So now you've
cut your teeth in your science and your sort of locality. Mm-hmm. Now you got your first superintendency, nailed it. And this is at, you know, a super regional park that of course crosses many jurisdictions. And then what's your next promotion? Where do you go from there?
So from there, I went to Great Basin National Park
right.
in eastern Nevada. And that is the park that is known for the oldest trees in the world, over 5,000 years old, bristlecone pines,
yep.
as well as a large cave called Lehman Caves, which is a large limestone cavern in the cave.
Yep.
And much more traditional park, and it's a very remote part of Nevada. It's an extremely pristine park. So I went from a very altered ecosystem in the Midwest to a very pristine ecosystem where the ecosystem was generally functioning at a very high level.
Right. Now, Great Basin, that's a weird name. I think I know what it means. No, that's fine. Do whatever you want. I don't care. You know what? Hey, did you guys not like the clicks and pops? I don't care. It's my podcast. Tune out. Great Basin. What's that mean?
So Great Basin is an area. The park was representing a large geographic area that is an area where water actually doesn't flow to the ocean. It actually flows inward, and it never reaches the sea.
It is immune to the continental divide.
It is. It is. And so it is. All the water flows in, and so this represents the best of what Great Basin had. It had a 13,000-foot mountain. It had the oldest trees, and it had this limestone cavern. It was really an exceptional part of the Great Basin, which covers most of Nevada, parts of Idaho, parts of California, parts of Utah. It's that part of the country where none of the water that falls there actually reaches the sea.
Right. What is the name of those sedimentary runoffs that come off when I'm totally forgetting my AP geology. It comes off the mountains and it hits a level. The water hits a level sand bed and then just dissipates and creates a fantail. What is that called? Or I think it's just called
alluvial fan.
Oh, it's called alluvial fans. Yeah, there we go. I sort of got it. All right, cool. Alluvial fans. Were there a lot of alluvial fans there?
It was all about alluvial fans,
yeah!
My friend.
Alluvial fans are...
You are a geographic master.
Alluvial fans are the shit. They're so cool. They look so cool.
It was. And the best part of this is because it's Nevada and it's kind of dry,
yep.
there was very little vegetation. So the geology was very exposed. And so you could see the alluvial fans.
It's
absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous place.
So, okay, Nevada-Utah border, you said, right? Is that in the Rockies or is that in a different system? What mountain range is that in?
It's not really in the Rockies anymore. Yeah. It's kind of in the Intermountain region between the Rockies and the Sierra Nevadas in California. Nevada is actually the most mountainous state of all the states.
It's also the most gamblingest and hookerinest.
we're not going to talk about that.
Well, depending on which county you're in at the time.
That's right.
Now I'm picturing where it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was that where the Great Inland Sea was?
Yes, that would be one of the many inland seas that the North America had.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
So we have fossils up at 12,000 feet.
Right.
Because it rose up.
And it's still completely, that's still completely exposed sediment, right. Sedimentary rock. I mean, the strata is still visible there. It hasn't been metamorphosed at all.
No.
It's just been uplifted.
Correct.
Oh, that's really, right. really
it's
cool.
It's a basin and range, so the fault lines are tilting,
uh-huh.
and so the mountains are tilting up high,
right.
and then you have these huge...
But you still...
So if you drive from Great Basin National Park uh-huh. all the way to Reno, or say all the way to San Francisco, you're going up and down 13 mountain ranges, up and down, 5,000, 4,000 feet, up to 13,000, up and down.
But they're like recumbent folds, though, so if you drove a tunnel through it, you'd be going through like year one, year 30 million, year 30 million year one, right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay, yeah. I think we're gonna be driving through that on my road trip, or at least I'm gonna be driving through that area, the basin, right?
You're going to Portland. You're going too far north.
No. And then I'm going Reno, Las Vegas, Grand Canyon. Will I be driving?
Reno, Las Vegas. Yeah. So you're gonna be skirting the edge.
Skirting the edge.
You're not gonna go across. So the mountain ranges are all north south.
Uh-huh.
And they're not east west. So you're gonna
got
be on the.
But I will be driving valley. In what was that Great Inland Sea?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So now. Basin is legendarily remote, right?
Yes, it is. And so our closest grocery store was 75 miles away. Our closest
yep.
hospital was 80 miles away. That was very challenging to be in, but it was also very exciting. So what that created was the lack of development created very dark night skies.
Yeah.
And so the light pollution was almost minimal to the point of some of the best skies you could have in North America, if not the world.
Also, are the weather systems moderate there enough to, like, what's the ratio of clear skies per year?
300 years plus of sunshine.
300 years?
Yeah, 300 days. 300 days of sunshine. Yeah, well, 300 years of sunshine,
I mean,
too, but
with the gray beard and the Gandalf-y-like presence.
bird! I love it. Oh,
you great. Shall not pass! Yeah, that's right. Great Basin National Park. Next it left. Does. Gift shop on the... exit through the gift shop. And no one gets to see that anymore.
Right. And so the lack of humidity plus the lack of light pollution creates some of the most exceptional astronomical viewing that you can have. In fact, in my time there, working through our friends group, we were able to build a small astronomical viewing area that is used by several research universities for students to learn more about the astronomy and do that type of scientific research.
How many black helicopters in that one? Because you're close to Groom Lake there, aren't you? Allegedly. Are you close to Groom Lake?
They took it away. I had one, and then they took it away because I used it too much.
Who's on first? Black helicopter. I don't know. Third base. That's cool. Light pollution is one of the pollutions that no one really thinks about.
Correct, yeah.
But it throws off migratory birds. It throws off insects.
That's
it
right.
throws off all the things that consume and operate in these spheres. Is light pollution just sort of, we're going on a tangent here, but is light pollution just sort of like, that's a fight we lost. We can't stop that pollution.
That is not accurate. I don't think it's a fight we have to give up. In fact, right here at Redwoods, we are becoming what's called the Dark Night Sky Park. And that is a way you can create if you put shelters on your lights and point the light down where it's really needed. You don't need light point shining up at the sky.
Right.
It's just a matter of changing the fixtures over time. And so and there are different cities and counties.
So you have
that
a mandate you're working on right now to implement that.
That's right, even here at Redwoods.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And we did that at Great Basin. It's a matter of just making the light point down. It's very simple. And so it doesn't, why waste the light shining up and ruin your night skies when in fact you can point it down where you need it?
Well, who is going to know that Xerox owns that building, you know, or whatever. I guess being a New Yorker, it's pretty hard for me to like all the lights point up in New York, we're bigger and better. Why do I always divulge? Why do I always just degrade to this? I always come back to this voice. I want to talk about Zeppelins and the Kaiser.
I know.
So we can fight light pollution.
Yes, you can, and it's quite economical, and it's not a huge deal for a city or a county to take on an ordinance that would say over time as you're replacing lights that you're going to make them pointing down and provide some light shelter so you reduce the light pollution.
Oh, well, we do it anyway with mandates and laws stipulating LED or compact fluorescent lights. You can't buy iridescence anymore, so you just do the same thing. It's got all external fixtures have to be pointed downward.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. That's some Occam's razor shit right there, because it literally is the easiest solution. And I'm like, okay, hey. So everyone out there, light pollution solved. Point your lights downward.
And done.
And see you next week where we tackle plastic in the ocean.
That's right. I'm on that next.
you're like, yeah, you know, actually, I'm not in on that one. you can't point the plastic down.
That's right.
So Great Basin, that's a challenging time, right? But this is still in the motions of working your way. You sort of said, or you made an oblique reference to, not by the way in a negative way, but the Park Service is in a way sort of paramilitary. There are ranks and hierarchies. No one thinks of like, well, park rangers, you know, they've got someone to answer to. I don't get it. Tell.
Yeah, so the Park Service and all the federal government, but especially it seems in the agency I can speak to about the Park Service, is that different parks are kind of in different zones and based on your pay and kind of and categorized
right, like
by that.
The G7s and the O4s and whatever. Everyone's got their
I wasn't
going to
get technical, but it's GS, General Service.
So
there's like 13 parks and 14 parks and 15 parks, and then there's actually even another level higher than that, which goes into the Grand Canyon type parks, these senior executive service parks.
Right.
And so you kind of work your way up through those, but they're generally representative of the complexity of the park in terms of the political issues, the ecological issues that you have to deal with, and in some cases the visitor service issues that you have to deal with, the amount of people you have.
Right, and obviously there's a hierarchy. Like, is there like, oh my God, It totally is like the Navy. Like, you start on a patrol boat, you don't get a carrier out the, you're like, hey, I just graduated. Here I go. I'm in this voice again. I just graduated Annapolis, class of 32. Do I get the USS Lexington or what? No, you get PT-109 and you get sunk, Kennedy. You know who doesn't get sunk, Kennedy? Winners.
Oh, come on.
Literally, it was 1944. The guy can deal with it. No, but you're right. Oh yeah, I told you we were going to go off the charts with this one. By the way, you could write your angry letters to Steve.
That's right.
care of Congress, because that's who he answers to ultimately, right?
Yes, that's true.
So that's where the ladder stops, right?
Yeah, so ultimately, I work in the executive branch.
Oh,
so my boss is the president. Yes.
Okay.
Not Congress,
cool.
But yes.
Oh, yeah.
Congress
okay.
passes the legislation that authorizes the park,
right.
And those are the rules we follow.
Got it. But your boss is.
But my boss,
the president.
I work in the executive branch.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes, the
correct.
President. And we'll leave it at that.
Correct.
Yes. The president, whomever it may be.
Yes.
You've been through several presidents.
I have.
So now you've worked your way up to a basin, which is. Enormous, right? What's the acreage?
No, actually it's not.
It isn't?
No,
it sounds big. Great basin.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
No, it's only 77,000 acres.
Oh, only 77,000 acres. Give us a scope on that. Is that Rhode Island?
No, not even close. No. It's you know, 20, 30 miles by 20, 20 miles wide.
And so
it's not huge. It really is. They really tried to try to pick the most significant part of the Great Basin. But in terms of the Great Basin size, which is enormous geographic area, it's actually quite small.
Oh, okay. Okay, got it. Mm-hmm. So it's like Rhode Island. No one actually knows how big Rhode Island is.
I was going to say, like, you're going to have to tell me the acreage.
No one knows, but it's like, it's about the soda of Rhode Island. Like, that's pretty small. How small is it?
Mm-hmm.
And now Great Basin is probably a park that most of us have never heard of.
Correct.
How long did you serve there?
I was there for about 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah.
And what sort of, I mean, this might get into bureaucracy, but mm-hmm. I'm frankly interested in what sort of like metrics and assessments are applied to you to deem yourself ready to move on to the next step.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
So, from a park like that.
Like, what if you're terrible? What if you're not, obviously, because you have a proven track record. But how do they separate the wheat from the chaff?
Yeah, right. Good. That's actually a great question. And so there's a lot of factors that they look at when they're trying to hire superintendents to the level of like a Redwood National Park
right.
or Yosemite or Grand Canyon.
Right.
And a lot of that is you know, some type of political savvy, you know, mm-hmm. some type of understanding that you're working with the communities and the local relations. And so they're going to look at those things. How are you working with the local communities? How are you working with the local tribes?
Right.
How are you working with all those folks you need to work with that? Also.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
They're going to look at how are you managing your employees. Are they happy? Are they sad? Do you have productive employees? Also, they're going to look at how well are you at bringing funds into the park, bringing special projects in, those type of things. How are you working in those partnerships to bring those type of funds and special projects into the park?
This is truly political management to the T. Like, you're not just... You're not just the supervisor of employees. You're not just the overseer of a budget. You're going outside. You're going inside. You're going left. You're going right. You're going down. You're going up. You're going everything just to make this park a better place and make it operate to the mandate that it's been given. Oh my God, this is way more complex than I ever thought.
That's what makes it a great job.
Right?
That's what makes it so interesting.
Every
so
day you're wearing a different hat.
Correct.
Every hour
I'm wearing a different hat. Every meeting I'm shifting and pivoting to a different constituency that I'm talking to. I love it. So, I absolutely love it.
So to go back a little bit, we're going to get on to Redwood eventually. Now you said you worked at county parks in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up on a Westchester County, New York park, right?
I do, yes.
Yeah. And my dad was a laborer. My dad dropped out of high school. He was digging ditches and blah, 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 blah. Uh-huh. And then one day they're like, does anyone want to be the night ranger? My dad goes, sure, don't have to deal with my kids anymore if I'm the night ranger. I sleep all day and I drive around all night. Fair enough. He did deal with us because we'd be like, can we go out with you? He'd be like, want to drive around a truck till 4 a.m? I'm like, yeah, I do.
Absolutely.
snow plowing. Dad with the gas pedal, me with the steering wheel on
his
lap.
Yeah.
I think I ran my first snow plow at like 6 years old or something like that. And it was in like
awesome dad.
Oh yeah. And it was like in an old school Ford Bronco.
Nice. No.
It was like a 74, 78 Ford Bronco because it was in the early 80s, right?
Oh, sweet.
So cool. And then eventually my dad, he stopped being the ranger. And then all of a sudden he's like, my dad's an amateur artist. So he reformed one of the rooms in one of the farmhouses on the park. And he started putting up art galleries there. And then the next thing he knows, the Westchester County's like, do you want to do our Arts in the Park program?
Right.
So he's installing sculptures in all of Westchester County's parks.
Mm-hmm.
Monumental sculptures, 20, 30 feet tall by world-renowned artists. And then the Westchester County government changed hands, and then everyone felt that their severances were going to get cut. So they all took retirement and left.
Oh.
So my dad's been retired since.
Okay.
Yeah. But
that's a great story.
It is a great story.
Yeah.
So like that on a microcosm does for those of you out there listening, you might not be able to or might not have the academic credentials to get into the national park system. But for every one national park, there are literally hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of state, local, and county parks that have similar systems that operate similarly. And you can do this and you can help your community just on a way smaller scale. It still works and still helps. And parkland is immeasurable. Like, I am the product of growing up on parks. And look what that got me. I am so lonely. I don't know.
Absolutely. You know, I think the point is, I don't think that there's any one avenue to leadership within a park, and whether it's national, state, local, it all counts. It's all part of a rich mosaic of protected lands that help, they enrich our souls.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not just for wildlife. They're for us as well. And that is important. And whatever role you can play, engage on it. You don't need to be a scientist. That's the role I took, but you could be. There's maintenance folks who are superintendents. There's law enforcement folks who are superintendents. Any role that you want to take can become a superintendent.
Right. And each one of these facets, you get to put your own little hallmark on the park. And no offense to the scientist, but the scientist was overlooking digging ditches the whole time. But the maintenance guy gets in charge of the park. He's like, you know what? We need more irrigation ditches. Done. There it is. That problem that the parks had that they didn't know they had, the maintenance guy sees it from a mile away. The scientist's like, damn you, scientist.
That's exactly
who is it? Every time I think it was Rick and Morty or South Park or both. It's like, whatever you say, Mr. Scientist. Because apparently no one respects scientists anymore. Apparently. That's what I'm told. No one respects. Sorry, can't do your boss's impersonation.
yes, please no.
I will not. Please no. And then you get called up to the majors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Like, do you have to lobby, apply, throw your hat in a ring?
Yeah.
Or is it more like a meritocracy where people are like, you're rising and he deserves to go on this one? Or is it a hybrid of the two? How do you say, I really want Redwood? Or just do someone say to you like, he's the guy who deserves Redwood?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great question. And so I did several things to move from, it's a big step up from Great Basin to Redwood. And so to do that, I did several things, what we call in the federal government details, where I did 4 or 5 months in a different type of job. And so one of those was as deputy regional director in San Francisco. So I worked in San Francisco, actually a great office downtown. kind of overseeing a variety of parks, several, like 20 or 30 parks.
Right. San Francisco has a whole ecosystem of parks surrounding the area.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Or is this even bigger than that?
This is bigger than that. This is the entire Pacific Coast region. We have 70 parks in it. And so I was the second in command of the entire region. And I did that as a detail. That was my permanent job. So I did that to get some perspective on what it would be like to be out of a park, but in that middle level management, not in Washington,
right?
Not at the park, but in this regional level
management. Right.
So I did that for a few months. That gets your visibility risen. And then in addition to that, I went and I was superintendent for about 5 months at Point Reyes National Seashore, which is in just outside San Francisco. And that's a high-level park, similar to Redwoods, very equivalent. And so I did that to show them that I could handle that level of complexity in terms of political complexity of resource issues, those type of things. And with that, then when I applied for the job, I still had to competitively apply for it. I was in good position to then get the job.
Right. Okay. So, but you were gunning for Redwoods specifically, or other higher echelon parks, or was do you do a combination of the two, or do you have to throw all your eggs in one basket and be like, I'm going to concentrate all my effort on getting Grand Canyon, you know? Or, well, obviously Grand Canyon's like, right?
Right.
But I'm just wondering what comes first, the chicken or the horse, the cart or the egg?
So it's a very personal decision. So a lot of it is deciding with your family about what places would you want to live in, what places do you want to raise your children.
Yep.
And so Redwoods was on what we call a short list.
Yeah.
And that list got shorter and shorter over time as our children got older and older.
Right.
And so we're very happy to be here because this had the proper mix of community that we wanted to live in and the complexity of the job that I wanted to take on as a challenge.
And like Humboldt County is absolutely gorgeous.
Yes.
Your lovely wife, Stephanie, cooked us an amazing dinner. And you guys are, I know, yes. She is bowing when we should be bowing to her
right.
for cooking this. Where you guys have your community co-op right around the corner where you can actually literally pick your fresh vegetables that are seasonal year round, because apparently California is just the weirdest place on earth where it's 61 degrees and nice all the time. Must be nice. But yeah, you picked a lovely part of the country in which to live, and that's pretty special. Okay, first day in the door, do you have to, you know, shiv a bitch to make yourself known at Redwood? You're like, you gotta knock out the biggest ranger in the...
That's interesting. Wow, you are a very astute question. So yeah, so what is your approach, right? Is that management on that first day and your first year?
Or
is really something, now that it's my third...
You've got to set a precedent,
right?
But you can't ruffle feathers because...
You got it.
The institutional knowledge is
Correct.
Really important. Too often new people come in.
Mm-hmm.
If you came into a
yep.
smaller shop yep. and you're like, we're going to change
yes.
it, people be like, oh, we're small and nimble, we can change it.
Yep.
But if you come in a big place, institutional
yep.
knowledge is really, so there we go, back into the politics.
Exactly.
So what do you do in the
exactly.
first day?
And what are their blind spots that
right.
they're not seeing, that you're coming in as a new guy who sees this because I have some other experience that they don't have?
But then you also have to delicately bring it up, be like, by the way, you didn't notice this,
yeah,
you know,
dummy. You didn't notice the toilet that's overflowing.
Yeah,
you might want to get
yeah.
on that. Yeah, so
yeah.
you know, it's that type of thing. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So it is a balance between trying to assert what you think in your gut. You know right away. Your first month, you pretty much know pretty much 90% of what you need to do for the next 10 years of your life.
Right.
But how do you roll that out to a staff of several hundred people in a way that makes them feel engaged and makes them feel like they're part of it, part of the solution, and convince them that, you know, you weren't working on this, but let's go ahead and pivot a little bit to work on this type of issue. Yeah, that was important, but you know what? Times have changed. Let's go ahead and work on this type
yeah,
of issue.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a lot of what I spend my time on right now.
Yeah, so both harnessing institutional knowledge and preventing institutional inertia.
Correct. That's exactly right.
And yeah. How you like them semantics, huh? Yeah.
The larger the park gets, the bigger the ship is to turn, and slower it turns.
You're
yes.
talking
yes.
this, you know, the size of small corporations for some of these parks. They're enormous staffs.
They are.
What is the personnel of Redwood?
So that's a little bit of complicated
question. Oh, because we had the state
parks,
in there,
correct.
Too.
So I have this partner who's my equivalent who oversees several dozens of people as well who oversee the state parks, and then I have the national parks. So all together we have several hundred people with
right.
our partnership and people that work in our buildings very closely with us. It's hard sometimes to see the difference between a national, state, and some of our partners who are working side by side in our building. So overall there's several hundred people in the building.
Wow. Now how does that work with the state parks? I get it, but I don't.
No, and this is an extremely unique park. And so what happened was back in the 20s, Save the Redwoods League, which is a nonprofit, was recognizing all the cutting going on.
Was it John Muir? Or did he do the Sierra Club?
A little bit later than that. Yeah. And so what happened was they recognized that there was a lot of cutting going on. Redwood is a very valuable wood for a variety of reasons. Has a lot of lumber.
Right. Well, because it's big.
Yeah, it's big and it has a lot of economic merchantable value.
Right.
And so it was being cut even at that time in the 20s with that technology at an alarming rate. And then it accelerated throughout time. And so in the 20s, say the Redwoods League recognized this and they wanted to protect what we term as old growth redwoods, just pristine redwoods that have not been cut. And so they bought up a whole bunch of areas. They took folks on a tour. They were able to raise money. These are actually, and the crossover with the Park Service is fascinating. So some of the same people who were founding the Park Service in 1916 were also working at Save the Redwoods League to preserve some redwood areas.
Hold on, stop. The National Park Service was founded in 1916.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
But that gives it 40 years after the very first national park. What happened in the interim period?
Well, so it was at one point the National Park Service, they were managed by the Army, and each park was managed individually, but it became a service, a agency where they were managed as a single unit with single set of policies in 1916.
Aha, uh-huh. So each was like a sort of independent fiefdom upon itself.
Correct.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And that legislation, I have to say, in 1916 is some of the most moving legislation that has been replicated throughout the world. In 1916, we call it our Organic Act.
Yeah.
That was the key difference, and this is where America set the tone for the rest of the world that's taken on, is that we said we're going to protect these lands separate. We're not going to do them for timbering. We're not going to do them for that.
Yep.
And we're also going to provide, so we have this dual mandate. We're going to protect these lands and also provide for recreation and access. And so that dual mandate has been taken on throughout the world. We were the first to do it and we set the tone, and it is, some people describe it as America's best idea.
Well, yes. I mean, that was the title of the Ken Burns documentary.
Correct.
It was the parks, America's best idea.
Yes.
And there's some other quote, someone Google it for me and put it in the comments because I don't really care that much. But to paraphrase, was like, you could tell everything about a nation by its free space, or everything about a nation by its preserved land, or something along those lines was the quote. And I think that was a 20th century quote.
Yes.
You could tell everything about our country by the zeal in which we preserve our lands.
That's right.
Or nope, not going to go down that road. Not going to go down that road, Ted Cruz. He's an idiot. You don't report to him, so we could call him an idiot.
I don't.
Awesome. Ted Cruz, you're a fucking idiot. So in that interim period, the national parks were operating on their own. Now we've got 1916, the National Park Acts kick in, and that mandate has continued to this day.
Right. And in fact, it was strengthened with the 1978 Redwoods Act, where they said that what I said earlier, which is that every Park Service unit, whether it be a national park, a national seashore, a recreation area, they're all treated under the same policy with the same protection for future generations.
And this is sort of, but back in the 20s, we digressed a little bit. In the 20s was where the state and federal partnership kicked in, and why Redwood is unique.
No.
Meh.
So,
So,
Save the Redwoods League preserved these three state parks, which are now part of Redwood National and State Park. And so that was in the 20s, and those preserved until about the 60s. And in the 60s, there was recognition that there was very little. Right now, 95% of the original redwoods, the extent of the redwoods, had been cut down.
Right.
So there's only 5% left.
Right.
And so Congress recognized that in the 60s. In 1968, they designated Redwood National Park, and they drew a boundary that included these three protected areas.
Understood.
And so Congress kind of intended that there be a partnership, there be this, let's protect this ecosystem. So within this boundary that Congress drew in 1968 that established it, 45% of the old growth redwood that exists in the world exists right here in Humboldt and Del Norte County.
So, but it's only 5% of what was once.
Correct.
What would that have looked like? It must have been amazing.
Immense, giant trees running for hundreds of miles.
Oh, my God, that's insane. In case I turn to supervillainy, what kind of resources are redwoods good for? And I was,
oh, everything. So
no, I was saying that sarcastically, like I'm going to go start chopping out redwoods. Obviously, I'm not going to do it. But just in case I turn to super villainy, what can I get out of a harvesting a redwood?
Right. So why were redwoods so merchant?
Why are they? Right, I don't know. Right, like, because I think like pines, just pine, and
right,
oaks.
Yeah.
Oak you can make right. You know shipboards out of, and you know hickory baseball bats, and that's pretty much where I'm gone.
Right. And so these are also very old trees, not as old as a bristlecone, but they can live up to 2,000 years old. And mm-hmm. So the older a tree grows, the more dense, like an oak on the East Coast. In the West here, these trees are old, they grow slow, and there's natural tannins in the wood that make them resistant to rot.
Really?
So that's why people use them on decks and in fence, because it's just naturally resistant to rot. So
is there harvested redwood now?
Oh, yes, there is.
Oh, so
oh, yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
So ethically grown and harvested redwood is perfectly fine.
Yeah, it is.
Oh.
And there are areas around the park where wood is harvested right now using for sustainable methods that are totally appropriate to use, because they're working to actually helps, because like too many trees grow up, they need to thin the forest.
Oh,
and some
yeah.
of those are redwoods, and actually helps all the redwoods grow up.
Yeah.
And in fact, we're doing that within the park, surprisingly. A lot of the lands were already cut over within Redwood National Park when it was made in 1968. And so we actually had to go and harvest those.
They're planted too close together.
Correct.
That happens in pine forests in the Northeast.
Right. That's right.
When the Civilian Conservation Corps planted all those pine forests, they planted them all too close together, and now they all fall down. They're fire hazards.
That's right. And so we have that same issue here. And so we're actually, as a national park, which is unique, is that we've gone in and we're actually doing thinning within the park.
Right.
And we use some of the money that we make off that to then fund some of the restoration work in the creeks for salmon and other critters.
That's the total holistic makeup of the park system there in like this little microcosm.
Yeah.
Wait, I totally thought of something and I totally, oh, everyone, this is going to be really interesting. Oh, I hope. Do you know where Methuselah and General Sherman are?
Yes. Well, I know.
Do you know where they
are?
No, do you know exactly where they are?
Not Methuselah, but Sherman, sure. He's got a name on the tree. I mean,
oh, does it? I thought that was secret too.
You could drive up to it, dude.
Oh, can you? I thought Sherman was secret.
No,
also.
No.
Methuselah is secret, though.
Methuselah is secret.
Do you know where it is?
Yes, Inyo National Forest. It's in California. So the
oldest. Oh, it's not in yours.
It's not anymore, because they cut down the oldest tree in the world in Great Basin, which is why it became a park.
Oh.
And so this is the oldest tree. Yeah, Stephanie just provided a statue of it. This was the oldest tree, Prometheus, that was cut down. It was over 5,000 years old as a research project in Great Basin National Park.
Guess he didn't bring fire. Boom, Prometheus.
So now Methuselah.
You stupid tree. Okay.
So I find it fascinating. I find it fascinating that the oldest, tallest, and biggest trees
are all
within a few hundred miles of each other.
Yeah.
You could
right
drive them all relatively in a day.
Yeah, although there is one in Syria or Lebanon that is sort of vying for it too, I think.
Okay.
Or maybe it's the oldest.
Bring it on.
I think I'm remembering wrong. I think it might be the oldest still fruit-bearing tree. Maybe that's what it is.
That's fair.
That's fair.
These are all conifers.
Yeah, so you know what?
There's
you know,
fruit on that.
Conifers side. For life.
Yeah.
Wait. As I make fun of Lebanon, which has a conifer on its flag. So yeah, whatever, Lebanon.
They cut them all down.
Yeah, exactly.
Those were good ships at the time.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I thought Methuselah was in your park. It's in a different one.
It's in your national forest, which is in California.
But we do know where it is.
Yes. I don't know. You know where the general forest is. They do not disclose the location because
some idiot will go something dumb.
Correct.
He'll mean, I'm going to go climb the tree. Yes. Right, babe.
Let's cut it down for graduate school.
Yeah. Like the dumbasses who cut down Joshua trees in Joshua Tree Park. It's like, I'm going to go to Statue of Liberty and cut down the thing. What's that thing? Statue of Liberty. What a bunch of fucking morons. All right, wait. We got lost. It's late at night and I've been driving for a long time. What were we talking about?
Redwood National Park.
Redwood National Park.
The history.
Yeah. Where we are currently.
The history. And so that's how so the partnership was established in 1994 as a formal partnership. The intent of Congress could have been, some would say it wasn't, that those state parks would be turned over to the federal government and would become one large national park.
Right.
The state of California decided not to let go of their crown jewel, Redwood Parks. And so with that resistance in 1994, it was decided that we'd work in partnership. And so now we have this mixed workforce of state, national, and also partnership folks all working to protect and preserve the park. It actually is a great way to leverage the different efficiencies of different units. And so it also has its challenges, as any partnership would.
Now, I mean, that would, like, so New York has the largest non-national park in the lower 48, the Adirondack State Park, right? Mm-hmm. There is some challenges going on in the Adirondacks right now, because the public-private is leaning a little on the private right now. Yeah. So, like, one of those hybridized federal-state infrastructures would probably benefit the Adirondacks a little bit, you know? So it's good to see that it works. Also, it seems that, you know, California seems to have its head on its shoulders when it comes to the environment, unlike certain other states, Texas.
Certainly California is environmental forward, I would say. And, you know, we have 40 miles of coastline as well as part of Redwood National State Parks. And so there's a lot of it's extremely pristine coastline and ocean, which it's really incredible. And I think a testament to the great work that folks have done here in California to preserve their coastline.
That's awesome. Well, Steve has given us some amazing insight on how to get interested in your local and your state and national parks. What can you do to volunteer in the national park system if you're completely unqualified, but you just love the national parks? And even if maybe you can't volunteer, but how can you donate and help? Write your senators, write the orange clown. I don't know, that he can't read, so it doesn't really matter. What can we do to help the parks, support the parks, or enjoy the parks responsibly?
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. And so there are a lot of ways you can support the park. In terms of, anyone has a skill that the parks could use in terms of volunteering. I mean, and there's
I can think of one person who doesn't.
And we are always accepting.
You know who I'm talking about, right?
So we're always accepting of volunteers to do a variety of stuff. If it comes from pulling invasive weeds or helping us reach out to the school children to help them engage in the nature and learn more about it. There's a variety of ways to volunteer. In terms of donating, we're not allowed to ask for money, but we have many partners, including State of the Redwoods League and Redwood Park Conservancy, and every park has a group that helps them raise funds for that. You're always welcome to donate money to that or provide services to them, and that indirectly helps the park. So there's a variety of ways to help out the park. And of course, as you visit a park, maybe one of the most important things you do is to act in an ethical manner. I think if you see trash, go ahead and pick it up. I mean,
I know. Tread lightly. I grew up on a park. That's just the natural thing. People are like, what are you doing? I'm like, this is my backyard, bro.
Yeah. Yeah, just tread lightly if you can. I mean, realize that your impact, if you're visiting a park that has millions and millions of people visiting, that even your small impact on a cumulative manner will have an impact on those other folks. Think about the folks coming after you. They want to have that same experience at the Grand Canyon, at Redwoods.
Right.
So try to limit your impact if you can. And the rules are there to try to limit those impacts. They can sometimes be annoying, but think about, why are those rules in place? Oh, yeah, I get, because there's like, they get 2 million visitors. They can't have everyone doing this.
Right. I just saw on BuzzFeed, there's a new trend about trail runners running and picking up plastic water bottles part of their trail run, which is pretty cool.
That's cool.
Also, I just remembered, I was driving my car with Frank Bottino in it, and we were skirting the edge of my park, the Pound Ridge Reservation, and Frank Bottino threw a bag of McDonald's out of my car, and I stopped him and I turned the car around. I said, Frank, get the fuck out of my car and pick that up. And he's like, are you kidding? I'm like, no, you pick that up.
Yeah.
And then I waited till we crossed the border into Bedford, and then I said, you could throw it out, because Bedford is trash.
He's just kidding, folks.
Oh no, he could throw it out in Bedford. I made him pick it up again, but still, I told him he could throw it out in Bedford. what were we doing? That's amazing. So there's so many ways to support and go. Was it nps.gov, right?
Yeah. Go there, and there's a whole volunteer area that you can look at and find ways to help, or just reach out to your local park and just call them and ask, I'd like to help out, and they'll give you every park has somebody who helps volunteers find a way to engage in the parks.
Awesome. Okay, last question.
Yes.
Speed round. Favorite invasive species?
Oh boy.
Mine's the snakehead fish. That's the one that can walk, right?
Yeah.
the one from China, right? That can walk from pond to pond?
Oh yeah, yeah.
What's that called? Snakehead fish,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's an East Coast one. Yeah, so I've been in the West for
Virginia
too long.
Creeper? Virginia Creeper? That's East Coast too, right?
Yeah. You're an East Coaster, yeah.
Japanese beetles? They're invasive. Japanese beetles are invasive. That's another one.
I would say
there's a Japanese beetle to the right of us, and she's yelling, "Shut up!"
The Japanese beetle are, yeah, you know, those can be a problem. But right. I would say I spent most of my time with tamarisk, which is salt cedar, along the Colorado River. That was probably the biggest invasive species. It's completely taken over the ecosystem adjacent to the Colorado River and dominated the riparian ecosystem. I would say that's the biggest one that I've worked on in my career. But there are so many. It's hard for me to say. I'd say second to climate change, invasive plant species, also animals, but mostly plants, is the biggest threat to our national parks.
Yeah. No, my least favorite invasive species is white people, because they just...
I gotta call you on that. No, I think that engaging people in the parks is what gets you to support them and support these areas.
Oh, well, I was actually talking about entire continents. Politics. on that note, before I get Steve in any more trouble, please, everyone, if you are in Northern California, this is one of the most spectacular landscapes I've ever seen on Earth. And just the drive north from San Francisco is worth it alone. We drove hours in rain and sleet and a horizontal wind, and it was still breathtaking coming here to the Redwood National Parks and Redwood National and State Parks. Steve Metz, Superintendent, thank you so much for being here. Everyone have a lovely evening. Goodbye, Steve.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.